Hello and welcome to the Gandhara, the podcast by Radio Free Europe of Liberty, focusing on Pakistan in Afghanistan. I am Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. It's been some time since we have been reporting about presence of ISIS militants in Afghanistan. Now, the recent reports suggest that they might come to the point that they could or already plotting attacks from their bases in northern Afghanistan. Also, reports suggest that among those militants are people as far as from French-speaking communities in Africa or France, and they are reportedly providing technical trainings for ISIS fighters there. Which leads us to another major question. What is really cooking up in the north? Where are all these people coming from? And more importantly, what are short and long-term implications of growing ISIS in northern Afghanistan? To discuss all these pressing matters, I'm joined by a panel of really distinguished speakers with unique insight to our today's topic. From Washington, D.C., Caitlin Forrest is joining us, who's the counter-violent terrorism analyst and operations manager at the Institute for the Study of War. She closely follows ISIS's foreign operations. Also from Washington, D.C., Barmak Pujwak is joining us, who's the senior South and Central Asia analyst at the U.S. Institute of Peace, who is originally from Afghanistan. Abu Bakr Siddiq is with us from Prague, who edits Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Okay, let's get started with you, Caitlin. Your recent report about the ISIS plotting attacks from Afghanistan, is it kind of both revealing and scary? We were reporting about increasing presence of ISIS in northern Afghanistan for some time now, but your report takes the level of threat to an entirely different stage. Tell us more about this.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we're trying to really talk about and raise awareness on is that this presence of diverse foreign fighters from around the region and, as you mentioned, as far away from as Europe, indicates that this group is part of a global network. And that ISIS is actually leveraging these fighters to wage local and potentially external campaigns, which poses a threat not only to the region, but to the West and all the way as far as the United States as well.
Headline of your report, like ISIS plotting attacks from its bases in northern Afghanistan, is it based on what? Have you seen any such attack or any indication of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing we're most worried about is actually how ISIS Wilayat Khorasan may be seen as an external operations node and that ISIS is trying to use its presence in Afghanistan to foster this node, which it can then use to launch attacks and plot attacks against the homeland. We actually saw in 2016 that reports from the U.S. Justice Department that ISIS Wilayat Khorasan allegedly actually authorized a planned attack on New York City in early 2016 that was foiled by U.S. security forces. But we actually haven't gotten reports yet that we were able to eliminate that authorization node within Afghanistan, which begs the question is that where is it now? And is it possibly located in northern Afghanistan?
Let's move on. Barmak, yesterday you told me about the presence of French speakers among the ISIS militants in northern Afghanistan. We knew Chechens, Arab-speaking people, are seen among the militants in the north there. But French speakers, explain that, please.
I was in Kabul last week that this is what I was told by people from northern Afghanistan, that they have seen French citizens of North African origins in places like Saripol and Jozjan among the Islamic State fighters. And they are not only men, but both men and women. Mm. And even they said that some of them, they have families. And they are there, they have been seen in the markets, shopping for themselves. And this is for the first time in the recent years that they have seen those kind of foreign fighters in northern Afghanistan. Of course, the presence of people from Central Asia and Russia among the ranks of and leaders of Islamic State in that part of the country was long established, but this is the first time that they are seen. And I think that further shows the power vacuum and the gap of governance that is unfortunately predominant in northern Afghanistan.
Abu Bakr, let me bring you here. First, you are reading into the presence of French speakers, and earlier Caitlin was talking about ISIS potentially plotting attacks from its bases in northern Afghanistan. Second, what those foreigners are up to? I mean, there are hundreds of Central Asians there. But when we speak about Central Asians, we kind of agree on one point, that they are there to shelter before moving on to their destinations in Central Asia when time is right for them. But French-speaking Africans or Europeans, what are they really looking for there?
Well, I think we have to understand this phenomena, we have to understand the correct background or real story of these folks. One thing that people need to understand is that up till 2014, most of these people who are now gathering again in Jozjan in particular, but also right. across northern Afghanistan, were people who were sheltering in Pakistan, in the tribal areas, particularly in North Waziristan. Hmm. In and around Miranshah and north of Miranshah in Dande Darpakhail, where they were from 2005 onwards until 2014, there were hundreds of alleged U.S. or suspected U.S. Drone strike, which killed reportedly a large number of senior Al-Qaeda figures, but also militants from Xinjiang in China and Uzbek militants. The founder of IMU, Toher Yoldosh, was also killed in Waziristan in 2009. So these are all these people, basically remnants of IMU and some other militants who fled North Waziristan in the summer of 2014 when Pakistani military launched a large operation. And then they kind of wandered across around Afghanistan, and finally some of them managed to get to northern Afghanistan and, in a sense, establish a foothold. And these folks, the IS in Afghanistan emerged in 2015, but the IS in Afghanistan is really kind of two organizations in a sense. Part of IS in Afghanistan is made up of Pakistani and Afghan fighters, mostly probably remnants of Pakistani Taliban, remnants of TTP, people like its one of its first leader, Hafiz Saeed Khan, was a member of Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, or TTP. And then a lot of these Central Asian, they switched their allegiance from Taliban and Al-Qaeda to Daesh or Islamic State, or to be more precise, Islamic State Khorasan province in late 2015, I mean, summer of 2015. So these are all these folks. Now, I'll be a little bit suspicious about like hyping this to an extent that this is like a huge global threat. I think their numbers are still in hundreds, not in thousands. What has happened in Jozjan in particular, that a lot of local Taliban, or particularly some of the more criminal elements among the Taliban, have joined, particularly one Taliban leader, Qari Hikmat, has joined them. And the Taliban have so far been unable to defeat Qari Hikmat, despite launching a very big operation in October, in which reportedly there were hundreds of casualties.
Yeah, very interesting, useful background, Abu Bakr. Coming back to your point earlier, Barmak, the French speakers, they appear to be new arrivals. At least this was my sense from our conversation yesterday. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that, Barmak?
That's my understanding also, but I think what I heard in Kabul was that these are new arrivals, and I'm afraid they might be those who have left the battlefields in Iraq and Syria, and now they are in Afghanistan. But they are a new phenomenon in Afghanistan. I think they were not there before. Of course, as I said before, and as Abu Bakr said, that the remnants of the Central Asian fighters and the Al-Qaeda, they were there already in northern Afghanistan, but these people, the French speakers, are new to the region. One more thing that to add to what Abu Bakr was saying is actually a reason for the strength of Islamic State in northern Afghanistan, in addition to those criminal elements within Taliban and others that they have been joining them or supporting them, is also the weakening of the leadership of the Taliban in northern Afghanistan. I think they lost some of their more famous and acceptable leaders in the fighting in the last couple of years, and now they don't have a strong leadership. But at the same time, the Afghan government is also in a much weaker position there in northern Afghanistan, because the areas were controlled by the Vice President Dostum, and since Dostum has been sent to exile, he is not able to to supply and support his militia forces, and some of his militia commanders are either overtly or covertly supporting elements of both Taliban and Islamic State. So that's another development that's also seen in northern Afghanistan that is also playing in favor of both the Taliban and Islamic State.
Definitely, we are going to talk about the local conditions which allows growth or presence of ISIS militants in northern Afghanistan in the second part of the discussion. But to expand a little bit something that Barmak has said, Kathleen, maybe we can continue with you. Barmak said that at least the French-speaking people who are seen in northern Afghanistan recently are probably who have moved from Syria to Afghanistan. Is there any indication among the reports that you have seen so far that militants from Syria or Iraq are moving into Afghan battlefield?
Yeah, absolutely. So we haven't seen explicit reporting that that is the route the fighters are taking. But that is the next question that we're looking into right now is, where are these fighters going to go after Iraq and Syria? And so we're really worried that Afghanistan is actually going to be this next battlefield where they're sending a lot of the foreign fighters. And I think these first reports of these French speakers in the area are actually indicators of that. And that's what we're looking for right now.
Yeah.
Can I jump in quickly? Sure. I think one of the things to remember here is that there has always been this militant movement between what is Middle East and AFPAC theater. I think by 2014, a lot of these foreign fighters, meaning people who were not Central Asians or Afghan and Pakistani, had already left Waziristan and tribal areas, and they joined various groups in Syria in particular.
Right.
Some joined Al-Nusra Front, others joined Tahrir al-Sham, and some joined Islamic State, of course. Because if you look at Islamic State literature, their magazine, The Beak, had some articles in the past which kind of explained their differences with Al-Qaeda and how Al-Qaeda was doing terrible while hiding in Pakistan, because they were basically hiding. They were not trying to create an Islamic State there or impose Sharia or something. So it is possible that these people are coming back. And from the recent release of some of these bin Laden documents that the CIA released last month, we know that the Iranians and Al-Qaeda had some kind of contact. Now, I will be personally very surprised if the Iranians are allowing defeated Islamic State fighters to come to Afghanistan through Pakistan or some other means. But it's possible that people are trekking in from Gulf, because Balochistan is a huge region, kind of still with porous borders. And even I think this whole idea of porous border is very troubling, because nowhere in the world there are kind of these borders that are absolutely not penetrable, and people cannot just walk across borders. In Europe, as recently as 2015, we saw that we had a million people coming over from Asia and Africa. So it is possible that these people are going to northern Afghanistan, but I think we have to be very cautious and, in a sense, not try to hype this threat.
Oh, yes.
Because as far as we know, most of the activity is really limited to very local places or maybe attacks within Afghanistan.
Obviously, our intention is not to hype that. And also keep that in mind, that the entire ISIS threat in northern Afghanistan is something of new phenomena. So just to clarify that question here before we move on to the second point. So when we talk about presence of foreigners in northern Afghanistan, the group that is calling themselves as ISIS, how big of a group we are talking about? What's the estimated number we are talking about here, Kathleen and Barmak?
Well, I've seen not exact reporting, but there's hundreds of fighters from within Afghanistan and around the region, but there's relatively small numbers reporting of the foreign fighters. And so I don't want to speak too broadly and hype the threat either on that, but the idea that they're actually being able to receive any number of foreign fighters is concerning. And I'd just like to add as well on the local threat. So these groups, they are acting in the name of ISIS, and so therefore any success they have, whether it's confined to northern Afghanistan or not, actually bolsters ISIS's global brand. And so even though it may be a local threat right now, it actually can bolster ISIS in the long term.
Barmak? in terms of...
Yeah, numbers? My understanding is the same, that I don't think that the number is really big, especially of those that don't belong to the regional countries. But when you talk about ISIS in Afghanistan, I think, as Abu Bakr was saying before, they are mainly based in three parts of Afghanistan. We get news mainly about two localities that they are active and operating. That's eastern Afghanistan and Nangarhar province and Konar and along the border with Pakistan. But also there is a concentration of them in southern Afghanistan and Zabul province, especially in Khak Afghan district, that they settled there long before in 2012-2013, and also now we have them in northern Afghanistan, mainly in provinces like Saripol, Jozjan, in and around Kunduz and Badakhshan and Tekhar. But the number of the foreign fighters, I don't think that are, you know, more than hundreds or 1,000 or something like that in that part. But there are quite a lot of regional people from regional countries, like from Central Asia. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are Pakistani Taliban and Pakistani elements there, especially in eastern Afghanistan, but also some people from remnants of Al-Qaeda and other countries.
Mm. Yeah, just to add, I think it's relevant here. I was having a discussion on this number thing a little bit earlier with a parliamentarian from Faryab province, neighboring Jozjan, and he was also saying that their numbers are limited, but he also said that their number is not important. The skill that they are bringing is more important and more relevant, because a one bomb maker, ISIS member, could train hundreds of local Afghans, and that's really dangerous. So now the most important, I think, question is also how situation got to this point in northern Afghanistan, and how dangerous is it becoming, and what are their possible objectives of these foreign fighters in northern Afghanistan. And we will continue the discussion talking about this and many other questions shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Gandhara podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Majlis podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Central Asia from local perspective, and the podcast is published every week, most probably Saturdays, on Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate that today on Gandhara, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's podcast on Afghanistan, Pakistan. We are discussing recent developments involving increasing presence of ISIS militants in northern Afghanistan. Joining me in the discussion are Caitlin Forrest, who is the operations manager at the Institute for the Study of War. She closely follows ISIS's foreign operations. Barmak Pajwak is joining us, who is the senior South and Central Asia analyst at the U.S. Institute of Peace, who is originally from Afghanistan. Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, is joining us from Prague today, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. I am Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara podcast here in Washington, D.C. Abu Bakr, maybe we can start with you. Now, the pressing question is, from Middle East to Pakistan-Afghanistan border, and from Pakistan-Afghanistan border to northern Afghanistan, now we are talking about Jozjan specifically. How IS members got to this town in Jozjan? What brought them there?
Well, I think one of the main things that we have to understand is kind of this maze of war in Afghanistan. I mean, the war in Afghanistan, I mean, the current phase at least, it started as an anti-terrorist operation. And it was basically aimed at Al-Qaeda, which, of course, was responsible for the 9/11 attacks. But then it turned into kind of a nation building or half-hearted nation building, stability operation, and all these things. And right now, what has happened is that in all this kind of maze of war, where the various players, the various stakeholders are not clear or not clearly defining what their end state is. For example, is the end state a stable Afghanistan where there is a central government that can establish a rule of law or something, or it's just killing a finite number of insurgents or people called terrorists or labeled as terrorists? So in this atmosphere, it's not surprising that there are these new groups emerge, and then Of course, a lot of these people, these things also prompt kind of wild conspiracy theories. I mean, Karzai most famously in recent months have been telling everyone that Washington, he was blaming Washington for the rise of IS in Afghanistan. The Russians have their own conspiracy theories, so does the Iranians, the Pakistanis, and so on and so forth. So particularly, I think what is needed is to first define again with very clearly what the counterterrorism mission is, who is a terrorist, who is not a terrorist, and then go on. For example, one of the things that we have not discussed till now is this whole fighting between Taliban and IS. I think Taliban have so far done much more, if not, I mean, whatever the U.S. and the Afghan forces are doing, they've done equal damage to the to IS. I'm not saying that they're better than IS or whatever, but I think the IS threatens their existence and their claim as the legitimate, whatever, flag bearers of jihad. In Barmak mentioned Zabul. In Zabul province in 2014, the Taliban nearly killed all members of the that IS Uzbekistani, not Uzbek, because they're Uzbek, Afghan Uzbeks, Uzbekistani cell of IS that was entrenched in Khaki Afghan and some other places where they had kidnapped some Hazara Afghans and they were threat to, they had engaged in atrocities. So I don't look at it at more like this specific tactical issue that because there are loose borders or because there is this one thing that is prompting these people. It's this whole maze of war where you don't have, the problem has always been that you don't have a clear end state, and then you have never mobilized enough resources to work towards that end state. And of course, terrorists typically and extremist groups typically thrive in those conditions.
Yeah, yeah. You earlier mentioned, Abu Bakr, the theories or rumors. Russians have different version, for example, Iranians forwarding their own version of why ISIS is emerging in Afghanistan. But that's aside. But one thing is fact here is that northern Afghanistan kind of became a hot spot from once being really peaceful part of Afghanistan as much as it can get in Afghanistan's situation. So there must be something special. There must be something which brought them to northern Afghanistan. Now we are especially talking about Georgia. What's in Georgia which brought them there?
I think the major development has been that always, the rise of Taliban in Afghanistan has always been looked at and written about and treated as basically a Pashtun phenomenon. The Taliban are these ruler Pashtun extremist mullahs who are crazy and all that. But I think the reality was much more complex. What we have seen in northern Afghanistan, this also includes northeastern Afghanistan, because Badakhshan is also now has a lot of problems, is this emergence of local groups. I mean, you can't have militancy in any place where you need to have some kind of local support. You need to have local networks to feed you, to kind of guide you. And all these people, maybe a lot of them were madrasa-trained people. There are a lot of madrasas in northern Afghanistan. A lot of people have been educated in Pakistani madrasas. There were all these people, but there are also critical problems of governance, of insecurity, of grievances. For example, you had a lot of these local warlords in every single province in Afghanistan. Powerful commanders often also working as, for example, the provincial police chief or provincial military chief or something. And these people engaged in abuses with nearly absolute impunity. So the only way people reacted in some cases, I'm not saying that all of this is, I mean, it's not a blanket thing. But in many cases, there were a lot of these very complicated local issues, and they paved the way for the emergence of local militant cells. And of course, the local militants won't thrive without foreign support, without foreign expertise. And then, of course, after the departure of NATO troops, that coincided with these Pakistani operations in tribal areas, where Pakistan simply drove all these people into Afghanistan. Afghanistan was not ready to, in the summer of 2014, Afghanistan was busy with a very messy election process, a controversial, two rounds of controversial elections. By the end of 2000, the foreign forces were rapidly leaving. So perhaps enough attention was not paid to maybe arrest these people or somehow deal with them militarily so they will not become a threat in the future. And the same goes for like a lot of other the sanctuaries that Pakistan provides to militants and the sanctuaries that militants have carved from them for themselves in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So without like very little attention being paid and little energies being spent on fomenting this kind of regional anti-terrorist cooperation. There is regional governments have only invested their time and their resources in blaming each other.
Barmak, let me get your point on this, like the fact that Jowzjan is in this situation today that we are talking about as a place where ISIS is kind of regrouping and they hold at least two districts, as far as I know from the reporting that I have read so far. And I believe today, as their territories are being diminished in Syria, in Iraq, probably these two, three districts in northern Afghanistan is the only place where they can claim of having a permanent territory in their control. So now Jowzjan becoming a hot spot. Is it only because of Qari Hikmet, or there is something bigger to that?
It's very much local, and I don't see a direct link between people like Qari Hikmet and ISIS in Raqqa or Syria. I think there was previously was said they are opportunistic moves by the former Taliban commanders because they have differences with their rivals, either over territory or taxation or control of population. So I think that is mainly that. But I don't think that there is an established connection between them and the ISIS global. But also the situation is not like this only in Jowzjan, but Faryab, Saripol, and other provinces in northern Afghanistan are more or less the same. In some places, you have pockets of Islamic State. In other places, you have a stronger presence of the Taliban. But so that is the situation. And as Abu Bakr was saying to me, one of the main reasons for this is the gaps in governance in Afghanistan in general, and particularly in the north. The government has failed to provide and protect the people and left them somehow at the mercy of those militia commanders. And these militia commanders, for their survival, they are happy to go to Islamic State. They are happy to go to the Taliban and to feed themselves and their soldiers. So this is a very much opportunistic movements by those people who were already there. They were already armed. They have just shifted from one group to another group and flying a new flag. But otherwise, they are the same people who have been kind of troublemakers in Afghanistan since even 80s and 90s.
Yeah. Yeah, Kathleen.
I would like to add, if that's okay, I'd like to warn as well that while this is an inherently, it is a local threat, and we know that Qari Hikmet was the former Taliban commander who then is now claiming his activities in the name of ISIS. We've actually seen that there is a connection between ISIS, Wilayat Khorasan in the east, and these fighters in Jowzjan. We've seen reporting that they've tried to send people from Jowzjan to Nangarhar to get training and suicide bombing. And so we also see now these foreign fighters also highlighting the fact that they're coming in, potentially transferring capabilities, explosive capabilities. I think that that is a great opportunity for ISIS global branding and for ISIS Central to actually come in and really take advantage of the little enclave that it's carved out in Afghanistan. And so I do want to just warn that as we look at this conflict, as it evolves, to take the lens that this could not just be a local fight, but actually have very global and regional implications as well.
Yeah, thank you very much for that note, Kathleen. I think we will also be able to know a little bit more about their status, local versus having some connection with the outsiders, by looking at their financial resources. I mean, what are the source of their income? Barmak Abu Bakr, who wants to take this question? I mean, I'm especially talking about the group who branding themselves as ISIS members in Jowzjan or the neighboring provinces.
I'm really not sure. I think they are involved in the drug trade. I think drug and narcotics in Afghanistan is a source of income for them. Taxation from local population is another thing. There was a news report today about Jowzjan, about exactly this districts of Darzab and Khushtepa, that, for instance, the Islamic State authorities have asked families of former government soldiers and military personnel who have been killed in the fighting, and they are receiving allowances from the government to hand over those allowances to them. For instance, those kind of, you know, extortion and things like that. Those are the income sources, but also, of course, drug is a main issue. And I think one of the reasons that Darzab and Khoshteba is a desirable place for control is also that's on the route for smuggling from Ghor and southern Afghanistan to the north and to the borders with Uzbekistan, and particularly Tajikistan and other places. So there are different sources of income. There might be some international sources of income also, especially from the Gulf, but I'm not sure, and I haven't seen any evidence of that for the people in the north. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Abu Bakr, your take?
Yeah, I think one of the major sources is, of course, all kinds of criminal activities. Criminality is the source of income for most insurgents in Afghanistan, be that illegal mining or drug trade or kidnapping for ransom or imposing kind of local taxation. But I think in tribal areas in particular, when they used to be, these Central Asians used to be there, they were, I mean, of course, some of the most hardened criminals, but also they used to receive some kind of funding from their Arab peers, who of course had then some kind of donations or funding, private, whatever, in the Middle East. So we can reliably say that without the money that different kind of Sunni extremist groups, ranging from Taliban to Daesh to the number of groups now active in Syria, they basically have a lot of funding sources in the Gulf countries. And then, of course, all Shia militant groups or various manifestations of Shia militancy are dependent on funding from Iran. I absolutely agree with Kathleen that, I mean, we are living in a globalized age, so there is always all these global connections, and which makes absolutely these people a big threat, and we have seen that threat manifest itself in everywhere in the world basically now. There is no continent that's free from this scourge. Mm-hmm.
Kathleen, do you want to add anything in terms of their financial connections across the border?
No, I think they covered it quite well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I am almost reaching to the end of the discussion, but final questions here. Now, what do you expect, Kathleen, maybe to start with you, what do you expect the impact of collapse of ISIS in the Middle East to have on the activities of local ISIS members in northern Afghanistan?
I think what we need to watch for and be most vigilant about trying to prevent is actually this ISIS group in northern Afghanistan becoming a regional hub for foreign fighters fleeing the evolving situations in Iraq and Syria.
Abu Bakr, maybe Barmak, whoever wants to take this. Anything Afghan authorities are doing about this group, this emergence of this group there, and how successful are they?
I think the Afghan government and the NATO forces in Afghanistan, they're not only fighting them, but also Afghan government is working with local communities in different places where they can reach and where they have. But you know that the capacity of Afghan government is also very limited, so they cannot address the problem all over the place. But I know that in some places they are trying to mobilize local population against these groups, trying to establish more of a relationship of trust and confidence with local communities. So the communities actually, they take care of these people and don't allow them to build up their bases there. But so they are doing work, but I think so far they have. We have to wait and see the results of those. But of course, the fighting and killing them is a matter that they are taking every day, and that continues.
Mm-hmm. Abu Bakr, final note from you.
So I think in Jozjan in particular, the government effort should be to reclaim Darzab and Shortepa, and then not only reclaim it, but hold it.
Yeah.
Because what the Afghan government typically does these days is that they send these special forces, who are, of course, very effective, to drive out militants. But then they don't have enough disciplined forces to hold the place, and then they don't have enough governance capacity to keep the population on their side. So they have to first figure out a kind of a post-transition a post-war strategy in a sense, in a very local sense, about these regions, because Derzab, as you know, is a very strategic region. It borders several of these provinces. And once, if they can establish stability in those two districts, they can win over the entire population of Jozjan, and that will be a good example for the rest of northern Afghanistan. To conclude, I think Afghan government has many challenges, but it also has all these opportunities, which sadly, it is not cashing on.
Right. I wanted to end the discussion with this note, but there is another pressing thing I can't avoid asking. Kathleen, you are sitting in Washington, D.C. What Washington can do about this at this stage?
Yeah, I think that what the U.S. should do and we should focus on is actually ensuring that we're supporting the ANSF and our NATO allies to ensure that they and the local security forces are properly trained and equipped to actually combat this threat. We can also support with airstrikes and ISR and ensuring, as we've talked about, that the populations have a better option to actually turn to than to ISIS.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your insight, Kathleen Forrest, Operations Manager at the Institute for the Study of War in Washington, D.C. And also big thanks goes to Barmak Pajwak, who is the Senior South and Central Asia Analyst at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you very much, Barmak, for joining us. And also big thanks goes to Abu Bakr Siddiq. Thank you. Abu Bakr Siddiq, editor of Ready for Europe, Radio Liberty's Gandhara website, which looks into Pakistan in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for your time and thoughts today.
Thank you.
Thank you. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Gandhara podcast in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.